Welcome back. We are now learning Eliyahu HaNavi part two, and this is really a phenomenal and fascinating section of Torah, where we're going to have a look at some of the details surrounding, actually perhaps starting in the more modern era. What's hard to sometimes square is to work out what Eliyahu HaNavi means in today's parlance, into the way we see him today, and the way he appears in Tanakh. So I'd like to try to merge the two today in our studies together. So first thing is just a very interesting story which surrounds Eliyahu HaNavi. The story is a story told about the Baal Shem Tov, where there was an individual who came to the Baal Shem Tov during the month of Elul, and he said, "Rebbe, I want to be able to see Eliyahu HaNavi." So Baal Shem Tov says, "I'll tell you how you can do this. Very simple. What you need to do is you need to go to the city of Minsk, and if you go to the city of Minsk, you need to go to the edge of the town but on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Take with you a lot of food, take with you some clothes, and I want you to go to the edge of the city. On the edge of the city, you'll find a shack, and what you should do is you should wait just before Rosh Hashanah is about to come in, knock on the door, and ask if you can stay there, and you'll be able to see Eliyahu." So the man says, okay. He explains to his wife. His wife's obviously upset. This is not a, but to see Eliyahu, we understand. And so off he goes. He goes off to the city of Minsk. And what's interesting is that he does exactly what the Rebbe says. And as the Rebbe described, there's this shack on the edge of town, just by the forest. And he kind of sort of wants to arrive a little early to see what's going on. So he looks around. He sees it's, in a state of great disrepair. The door has holes in it, the windows don't have full glass in them. It's obviously a very sad state of affairs. And finally he knocks on the door, it's just before Rajana, and he says, "May I stay here?" And the woman opens the door. Clearly a number of kids here. It doesn't look like there's anybody, any man in the house. And he says, "Would it be possible to stay?" And she says, "Look, we only have a one bedroom, here, but you can stay in the woodshed. But we don't have any food to offer you." So he says, "Don't worry, I brought food." And he says, "I'll share it with you." And so it is. He stays for Rosh Hashanah. He shares his food. He tries to go to Shul in Minsk. He looks around. He tries to stay up at night. But the whole Yom Tov, he doesn't see Eliyahu. So he goes back to the Baal Shem Tov in Mezhebush. And he says to him, he says, "Rebbe, I tried and I didn't see him." So he says, "Did you do everything I said?" He said, "Yeah, I did." He said, did you see Eliyahu?" He says, "I didn't." He says, "Ah." He says, "You know what you should do? For Yom Kippur, do the same thing. Come Erev Yom Kippur, come with food, come with clothes, and just before Yom Kippur, you should knock on the door, and this time you'll see Eliyahu." So the man says, okay, the Rebbe says, this is what's going to be, so that's what it'll be. He goes off to Minsk, he goes to the shack, he knows what it looks like, he knows how to go, and he's kind of waiting there. He thinks that maybe Eliyahu is going to come earlier, so he comes at the beginning of the day, and he starts waiting there. And what happens is that time goes on, as Yom Kippur comes close, he realizes if he's not going to eat before Yom Kippur, it's going to be a very long fast. So he knocks on the door, and before he knocks on the door, he just is listening, and he hears the little children in the background, and they're crying to their mother, and they're hungry, and they're one of the older children saying, "Mommy, Mommy, tomorrow's Yom Kippur, we don't have anything to eat." And the mother responds, and she says, "Don't worry, my child, Eliyahu HaNavi will come back like he did for us on Rosh Hashanah." And that man then realized that the point of the story was, what the Baal Shem Tov was trying to say to him was that, no, the Eliyahu HaNavis in our lives are perhaps us. I remember I once told the story to somebody. We were at the Kotel a number of years ago, and my wife was taking one or two of the older kids up the stairs, and there's no elevators there. So I was trying to bump the stroller up those stairs. I don't know if anybody's taken a moment to count how many stairs there are from the Kotel Plaza to get to the street, where the pizza store and the bookstore is. So, anyways, there's a lot of stairs, let me tell you. And so there was somebody who decided to help me, who just decided randomly, a non-religious Jew picked up the wheels and helped me. And as we were climbing up these stairs, I told him the story, and I said, "You can be the Eliyahu in somebody else's life." And it's a very meaningful, very beautiful story. What I'd like to do is I'd like to perhaps argue that the story actually emanates from our learning today, and in two distinct ways. Let's start learning together. We're going to start looking at Eliyahu part two, and this is about the story of what we're going to call the widow of Tsarfas, or Zarephath, as is described in English. So we're going to try to merge that story, the story about the widow in Minsk and the widow in Tsarfas. Yeah, let's start with the Psukim. We're going to look at Perek Yud Zayin, and we're looking at it in two basic sections. So if you remember, where we last left Eliyahu was, there was a drought declared upon the land based on his view of the sins of the nation of Israel. He is now granted shelter in the brook of Chris and is supported by the ravens and the water there. The water dries up because of the drought, and he is now sent elsewhere. So this is where we pick up. Vayhi Devar Hashem Elav Lemor. God says, speaks to Eliyahu saying, Kum Lech Tsarfata Asher Letzidon. Go to Tsarfas, which belongs to Sidon. Yoshav to Sham, and you should stay there. Hinei Tzivisi Sham Isha Almona Lechal Kalecha. I have commanded you a woman who is a widow to look after you, to support you. Okay, so be it. Vayokom vayelech Tsarfasa, he goes off to Tsarfas. Vayovo el Pesach ha'ir, he enters the city. Vihinei sham isha almona, there's a widow, mekosheshes eitzim, who's gathering wood. Vayikra elel vayomar, he turns to her and he says, kechino li ma'at mayim bakli v'eshte. Please give me a little bit of water so I should drink. And she brings him the water. And now he makes a second request. Please give me a little bit of bread. She says, ah, by the love of Hashem, I don't have any cakes. I have one little container of flour. And there's a little bit of oil in the jar. I'm trying to find two pieces of wood. We're going to make essentially the last supper. That's all we can make, and we're going to die. This is a time of drought, a time of famine. He says, don't fear. Go do what you said. Make for me a little bit of a cake. At the beginning, what says li and bring it to me, v'loch v'livneich ta'asi bo'achrona. And then make a cake for yourself and your son afterwards. Ki chomar Hashem l'kei Yisrael, so says God, kemach, kad kemach lo'tichle, your container of flour will not finish, tzapachas Hashem en lo'tichsar, and your cruse of oil will not be diminished, ad yom teis Hashem geshem al panei ha'adama, until the day that God will produce rain upon the earth. So she does that. Vatochal hivahu, and she eats with him, ubeisa, and her household yomim for a year. Kad kemach lekolsa, her jar of flour did not finish. Tzapach as Hashem and the jug of oil lechasar. Kidvar Hashem ashidibir biyad Eliyahu. As God says, remarkable, right? Very beautiful story. Obviously, a miracle he produces on behalf of this woman. Lot of fascinating things to think about. First question, just to cross locate, where is this place called Tsarfas? So, generally speaking, today Tsarfas or Tsarfat is France. He did not go to Europe. So we're talking about Tsarfas Asher Letzidon is a little city. If you take a look at the map over here, you will see the two prominent cities of Phoenicia were Tyre and Sidon. Sidon's a little further up the coast. Tsarfas belongs to Sidon, as we're told in the Psukim, so it's a subsidiary of Sidon. So it's all the way up north. So we ask ourselves, okay, why would he be sent there of all places? There wasn't anybody else. There wasn't anybody else who could support him. So if we go back and remember last week when we looked at his location, why he was sent to the Brook of Chris in the first place, why didn't Hashem just maintain his position in the land of Israel? So there were a few answers. One was the notion of Sakana, that Eliyahu was in imminent danger, meaning, here is the man who decreed famine on the land. Everybody is starving to death, and the agrarian society is falling apart. He would be lynched. So says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, find a safe place for yourself, Nachal Chris. So you can imagine that same logic would apply here. Here, leave the territory of Israel, go up to the area in Phoenician territory, where you perhaps will be a little more safeguarded. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is maybe it was, if you remember that Eliyahu decreed a famine, and he wanted it to be absolute. And if in his little area, there would be water, and there would be crops, and everything would be fine, so there would be this terrible land grab around Eliyahu. He'd be the, so to speak, this oasis of blessing. So Hashem said he sent him to the secluded brook, which you know doesn't seem to be accessed by anybody. In that way, his blessing will not overflow. There'll be no collateral blessing. Same thing might be true over here. Is maybe you're sent to Tsarfas, which is an area which is very much outside of the reign and territory of Israel. And maybe that's, it's in fact, it's emphasized that this belongs to Sidon, to Sidon, which would indicate that it is, therefore, the blessing will not impact Israel as well if he comes there. So those are two possibilities. A third possibility could be is that the city of Sidon is important to that story because it is the birthplace of Isabel, Jezebel, who in fact is the counterpart or the antagonist of Eliyahu, essentially. So one would wonder, I would wonder when thinking about this, if there's an element of perhaps whether it be education, exposure that Eliyahu needs to get in the precinct of where she grew up, of what's important to her, and maybe he's being sent there as well. Very, very interesting thing to think about in terms of why it is that Eliyahu is being sent in this direction. Okay, so this is in terms of just the location and perhaps some of the lessons we can learn. Now, one thing which is really quite strange is it kind of strikes one as somewhat insensitive. You know, here's Eliyahu. He's being told to find this Isha Amona, a person who's a widow. In those days, it was generally speaking the man who was the breadwinner. And so we can imagine she's probably not in a state of great financial grounding. And he goes up to her and he starts asking her for water and bread, and it's a famine, you know, on top of all of this. So what's going on over here? What's really happening over here? So the truth be told is the Mefarshim say, at this point in time, he doesn't know who she is. So for instance, Rashi says, in a very powerful statement, he says in source 5, he says, "Kechina la'ni ma'at mayim, please give me a little bit of water." Hu lo haya makir ba'almona. He didn't know who she was. God says, go to Tsarfas, find this woman. He doesn't know. He doesn't know who she is. So what does he do? Shamar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who was told by Hashem. V'lomad me'eliezer v'adavram v'amar oysa shetiten limamayim nishtoes hi ha'almona. So in a certain sense, this sounds very much like another story, the story in Chaye Sarah, where Eliezer is trying to find a woman. He's trying to find the marriage partner for Yitzchak. So he goes off to Haran and to Aram Naharaim and he's looking and he makes his test, whoever gives me to drink. So maybe what he's saying is, learning biblically, Eliyahu says, I don't know who this woman I'm supposed to meet is. I'll ask somebody for water perhaps, and maybe that'll be the entree, this will be the opportunity of being able to know who this is. The Malbim says, puts it a little further, he pushes this envelope a little further, and he says, maybe actually, it's not about that he's just starting to strike up conversation or set up a test. He actually wants to know who, he understands that in a certain sense, this person will be a person who actually is needy. So he wants to work out what her needs are. He wants to know what is lacking to her. Imayim olechem. Is she missing water? Is she missing bread? He asks water. That's why he left, because of lack of water. So now once he knows that she isn't lacking water, then he asks her for bread as well. So as opposed to being an insensitive gesture, this is actually the heart or the epitome of empathy, because he's trying to work out what it is that she's lacking to perhaps in even help her, which is ultimately what he does do. So that's just perhaps a way of reframing the conversation and how it starts. Now, that's from the perspective of Eliyahu. Why is Eliyahu asking her for this? But let's ask a bigger question, a more meta question, which is, why would Hashem set it up as such? Meaning to say like this. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to sustain Eliyahu, there are numerous, you know, called channels that God could construct in this world to be able to sustain Eliyahu. As we saw beforehand, he was even using ravens as the conduit beforehand. So now, why is he going all the way out of the way, you know, sort of to find this almana as the source? He couldn't even find any way which was more likely as well. So the Mefarshim do this. As an example, the Abarbanel says, Aval inyano, the truth is in this case, in source 3, Shakosh Baruch Hu zimen shma isha amona, shelo yiye lo bal, ולא טיפול אחר כי אם ילד אחד, והיא תסתיראו בביסוב על ידו, תהיה מזונוי וחיל קולותוי, וכן היו, כמו שנזכר. So he's trying to find it in a way that this is a woman who, so to speak, her only responsibility is this child. She'll be able to hide him in her house, and therefore it will be, and al yada tiyemizono. So Hashem's plan, in a certain sense, is to find him a nondescript location, a place where people would not suspect where he is, perhaps feeding into the notion of the sakana. However, this is a very, very powerful malbim, which is not just a malbim as a mefarish, but malbim as a theologian, as a person who's suggesting a deep idea in terms of how hashkacha works. And that is the following in source 4. He says, "Voyam mi'anachal tishter shefa hashkachis tered al adam kefi achanasai." Hashem's energy, Hashem's goodness in this world descends to a person based on their preparation to receive it. So, if you have not switched on your radio, you're not going to get your radio waves, no matter even if the radio waves are out there, right? So that's to the degree of kefi hachanasai, to the degree a person has set up their radio set, their receiver. Va'achar sher Eliyahu hechinis atzma b'masa azeh la'atzor ba'ara brocha ha'elyonam yiredes min lamata. Since Eliyahu was the one who switched off the tap, right? He closed the faucet of divine shefa to this world. Kein loy haya eshar sheterayed gamalav. The mechanics are, if he closed off the divine flow of energy, he was not able to access that energy. He himself was precluded from that. Therefore, kein loy eshar sheterayed gamalav v'lachen loy eshar lefanas asoy al yedei shiim sabracha belachmoy. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu could not say to Eliyahu, "Eliyahu, your bread will continue to be blessed. Eliyahu, your water will continue to flow." As Hashem did do with the almanah. This is against his preparation, because he has switched off the radio set. While he was being fed with over here was things which are already extant. The river was here, it's not getting any more water as it dries up, but you can sustain yourself from it. There is the lechem and the basar was actually not fresh and new meat. It was meat that they were able to find, and perhaps as carrion crows, they were able to bring meat that he could sustain himself on. But there's not a new bracha based on this malbim. If you think about this, let's think about this for a second. In a funny sense, Eliyahu, who may perhaps need to be sustained, is not able to be sustained because of his own decree. So he is on the grid of which he just essentially pulled the plug of power from. And therefore he needs to find sustenance from outside the grid. So first round was the remaining existing bracha which existed, but no new bracha, the brook, the meat. Now, if Hashem wants to perform a miracle and use a tap in a certain, we'll call it channel of energy, it has to be through somebody else in order for him to access it, says the Malbim. So therefore, it has to be through this widow that the miracle is happening. Which gives us a really fascinating tension, and because we ultimately we now can ask ourselves: so who is sustaining who? Meaning, ultimately, in the end of the day, Eliyahu is performing a miracle for this woman, and that's now allowing her to have more than just that Last Supper that she was talking about before she dies, right? On the other hand, essentially, she is the one who's sustaining him, because were it not for her to be the conduit of the bracha, he would not be able to receive that bracha because of the decree he made. Which really goes to one of the fascinating textual points in this section. If we go back to the Pasuk Tes Vav, you'll notice that there's variations as to how the Pasuk is read. It describes, Vatoichal, he vahu ubeisa yamim. She and him and her household were sustained for a year. If you look at those words carefully, you'll notice that there's two variations. One is what's called the ksiv, the way it's written in the actual script of Tanakh. If you were to put out a parchment, it would be written hu vahi, which means who, he and she. But the way it's read is he vahu. That's the kri, is her and him. So written again is him and her. Read is her and him. Which really sets up the exact dichotomy of what is going on. If we think about it for a moment, who is sustaining who? So if you look at it superficially, you say, well, he performed a miracle for her to be sustained. But if you look, that's the ksiv. But if you look a little deeper, you'll realize, and this the Radak points this out, is that really she is sustaining him. There's this interdependent relationship which is being created between the two of them, through him, through her, for him, and for ultimately for them. Another interesting aspect of this, which we have to think about right now, is the idea that the miracle he performs for her, yes, is certainly miraculous, but in the end of the day, he is not giving her, you know, this bountiful spring. It's this small little jug and this small little container, which are not ending. So it's a very limited. It's a, so to speak, a daily required miracle. So today she pours out of the oil container and she has oil, and tomorrow she comes back and there's still oil. But it's not as if, you know, she dug a hole in the backyard and oil started coming out of the ground, and now she has, you know, bath loads worth of oil. It's a very limited miracle as well. So just to put things into fuller perspective as well. Okay, so that's sort of we'll call it step one in the story. But now the story continues. The story continues with the next section, which is now becomes even more fantastic, and then perhaps we'll take a look at some of the perspectives of this as well. And this becomes the story of the resurrection of the dead. So things get a lot more serious now, and fantastic and really incredible in the real sense of that word. We're told in the last Psukim Yud Zayin to Chav Dalet at the end of the Perek, Vayhi acharei dvarim ha'eleh, chala ben Yehoshua ba'ala ha'sabayis. So the child, the son of this woman, is falls sick. His sickness develops to a very strong degree, until there's no soul left in him. She turns to him and says, "What do I have to do with you?" Man of God, you came to me to remember my sin, to remind Hashem of my sin, to kill my child. And he says, "Give me your child." He takes her from her, and he places the child on his bed. And he calls out to Hashem, and he says to him, "Hashem Elokai, Hashem my God, also with this widow, you now fighting with her to slay this child." Right, this is not a prayer; this is a complaint. The next pasuk is a prayer. He stretches himself out upon the child three times. He calls out to God and says, "Hashem Elokai, Hashem my God, Tashavna nefesh hayeled hazeh al kirboi, return the soul to the body." One of the most fantastic moments here in Nach, where there is a explicit supernatural experience where the soul returns to the child. And he lives. Vayikach Eliyahu sayelad vayiridayu min aliyah habayis vaitnei li'imo vayomer Eliyahu rei chai b'neich. He says, "Look, your child is alive." Atomer shol Eliyahu atoz zeyodati ki ish alakim ata. I now know that you really are the man of God. Udvar Hashem b'vicha emes. And the word in your mouth is ultimately true. Okay, so just a very, very, very fascinating discussion. Discussion. Now, there's a lot to think about. A few basic questions is, if we go back to that first pasuk over there, we have to ask ourselves, did he actually die? Did the child die, or was he just sick? Did he go into a state of, you know, semi-comatose state? Was Eliyahu, so to speak, the medical practitioner, or was he the supernatural practitioner? So the Mefarshim bring a debate in this matter, and most of the Mefarshim say, no. When you read those words, Lai Nasra Bo Neshama, that there's no Neshama left in him, that means to say he is dead. He is motionless. The soul has left the body, is on his way of transition into the next world, and Eliyahu interrupts that process. So we're talking about, we don't try it in any way to rationalize or to explain this out, which is why the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim points out that the text actually goes to tell us that he was very sick. I mean, to say this wasn't just a sudden thing where you could say maybe he fainted. This was that this was a progressive situation, and it led to the point that he was no longer alive. So now, let's focus on two points. Two arguments. The first argument is what she says to him, what she says to Eliyahu. The second argument is what Eliyahu says to Hashem. Those are two most critical aspects of this conversation and story. So the first thing is her argument to him. So she says, she complains to him, "What do I have to do with you? Why do you do this? Why do you bring me here to remind me of my sin?" So now, why this child is dying is hard to know. We do know that there is a drought, there's a famine going on, so it could be likely, and we'll call it on the basic side of things, to say that what is really going on here, what is really going on is this child is one of the many victims on the lower rungs of society, the malnourishment and spread of disease during times of drought and famine. He is maybe a victim of that. But the woman doesn't look at it from that perspective. The mother says, "Lazkir es avoni, to remind Hashem of my sin." This, by the way, should remind us, just as a footnote, of the story which does happen later on in Tanakh about the Isha HaShunamis. We know that one much more familiar because it is the Haftarah of Parshas Vayera, where Elisha, the student of Eliyahu, resurrects the dead. That's a separate story. This story is not we don't know as well. It's not a Haftarah. So that's why it is lesser known, but Elisha actually derives the power of resurrection of the dead from this story. We'll see why when we get there, God willing. That's going to be in Melachim Beis. But in the meantime, so this woman, the mother, the Almana, says, "You came to me to remind Hashem of my sin." What does that mean? What liability does she have? Why is she upset about this? So the Mefarshim discuss this in great detail. And the Ralbag, as an example, Gerasonides says a very, very powerful idea, and that is that, you know, Eliyahu HaNavi is a very, very pure, very, very, you know, ethereal, sublime human being. He lives, obviously, a very, very spiritual life. And this woman's saying, look, I live an average life. I live a, you know, day-to-day life. I'm not a sinner, but I'm not a perfect person. I'm, you know, kind of, you know, in the average category. And Akash Baruch Hu has been judging me with an average, you know, an average rod, so to speak. You know, he measures me up to average people. But you know what's happened is now that I've invited you into my house, what's happened is that the measuring rod, the bar is a lot higher now. Because you're in my house, so you brought divine judgment to my house. Now that's fine for you, Eliyahu, living upstairs in your room, but in the end of the day, that impacted us, and I wasn't worthy to be judged based on your measuring rod. That it's not fair. So that's what the Ralbag says. Very, very sad affairs. In other words, I would have rather, says the woman, that you did not come here and sustain me, and I should not have suffered because of the judgment you brought into my house. That's one aspect of it. The Abarbanel gives another suggestion where he says, you know what? He says, maybe, Shaloi avaraticha karoi nechshav li la'avon. You know what? When you came to my house, you're the man of God, you're the prophet of Israel, and maybe I didn't get the coffee early enough in the morning. Maybe I didn't bring the newspaper in properly. Maybe I didn't greet you in a way that was becoming. Maybe we didn't rise when you walked into the room sufficiently. Maybe there was something which was missing in the way we treated you. So because you are here, it gave room for our lack of success, for our failure to support you in the correct manner. And it's because of that. So I would rather that you have not come and given us this opportunity, because it ultimately became our demise as well. That's the second possibility. And the third possibility which exists is the Chida. Chida points on something which should be on our minds. The Chazal, he quotes Chazal, he says, "B'tashmish amita," moral relationships. What does that mean? V'utamo, what does it mean? Upir shuzal, she'akavonoso she'olam birosom she'atokan, zman rav yachshiduni boze. They say like this. What's going to happen? The neighbors see the prophet of God goes to the widow's house. She's a single woman. She's living alone. He's staying there. And the neighbors say, well, what must be going on? And therefore, they suspect that the reason why he's staying there is not just because Hashem sent him there, and not just because he's sustaining her, but because there's something else going on. And that, therefore, reflects terribly on me, says the Almana. He says, again, this is what's mazkir li avon, you're reminding me of sin, is not actual sin, but suspicion of sin. And therefore, that ayin hara, therefore, of what people are saying, this chashad that people, the suspicion that people are generating, is going to generate an audit of my books. And because of that audit, it could in fact impact me. That's why I'm understanding how ayin hara works. Very, very, very sad set of affairs. So, besach hakol, what this woman is saying to Eliyahu is, Eliyahu, I didn't want this. I didn't need this. I would rather have struggled with subsistence than to have been be dealing with you and having to have the schus of having you here and the danger of having you here because of your great spiritual prowess. So now that's in terms of what she says to him. Let's now turn to what he says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because remember there's two elements of what Eliyahu did. First, in Pasuk Chof, he argues with God. Then in Pasuk Chof Aleph, he prays to God. So praying to God was successful. But what grounds did he have? So actually the truth is, the critical argument here is in Pasuk Chof, and this critical argument here is actually one to be found in one word. There's one word in this pasuk which gives us an inkling into what Eliyahu is really, truly arguing about. So here we go. Let's read this pasuk again. He calls out to God. The child's dead on the bed, and he says, "Hashem Elokai, Hashem my God, Hagam Almana Asher Miskarer Imo Hari Oisa. Have you even hurt this Almana as well? Lahamis Esbana, to kill her child." So the critical word in this sentence, the word which really is the entire argument here, is this word Hagam. Also suggests that there's now an accumulation of evidence. Now there's an addition, there's, so to speak, almost as if Hashem's justice has gone one step too far. What does it mean, one step too far? So what's Eliyahu questioning? What's really the background to this? What's really happening here? So the Mefarshim suggest over here very, very powerful ideas, two extremely powerful ideas. And that is the following. Now, Bava now points out that in the span of the last two prakim, this is not the only case of a child dying. In fact, if you reverse the end of Perek Tezayin, as we learned last week, we see the story of two children dying. They are the children of Chiel. Why did the children of Chiel die? Because there was a curse upon those who built the city of Jericho, of Jericho. And Chiel was the one who built it, and the curse was that their child should die. That was the curse that Yeshua said in the name of Hashem at the end of the book of, the end of the, in Sefer Yeshua Perek Vav. Says that by Rabbi Linira. He says, what it seems to me, Shamar Agam al Ha'almana, what does it mean also by the widow? Lerabois b'nei Chiel b'Yisraeli, to include the children of Chiel who were also killed. Shemesu b'avon aviyim, who died in the sin of their fathers. Shenizkar l'mala, as was mentioned above. V'olav omar, k'moy she'asis l'chiel asher ishiya la'asois, asis l'almona azois, she'etiva la'asois imi. You're going to compare this widow to Chiel? Chiel, who did bad and his children died, you're going to make this widow like Chiel? That I'm staying with. God, if you're going to treat a tzaddik like a rasha, then it says Eliyahu HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Where's the din? Where's the justice? How can the child of a Rasha die and the child of a Tzadekis die? How can it be that you're treating them in the same way? Because ultimately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is going to reflect on the lack of justice in this world. And that is a terrifying thing. That was the argument that he was making. That was really what Eliyahu was doing. He was taking this contrast as part of his argument. But there's a much deeper way of looking at this, and this is what the Metzudas David says. And I think to me, this is really where everything in this parak is at. Here's what he says. Agama almana. Again, he's picking up the word of why it's also this widow. He says, "Rotzel omar, lo idai shara oisali lo leches nova non meshotet baaretz." God, you know what? You've made me a wanderer. You've made me a person, you know, slinking around in the shadows of society because of the curse I put. Al shatzartis amatar, because I made this decree. I'm not going to complain about that. Uvi gam al almono yecherelach al asherich nisa asib beisa. Hashem, you want to punish me? You want to show me that perhaps I was wrong? That's all right. What about her? Why should she be involved? Vareyasul hamis says benoy bavuzeh. Her innocent son, God forbid, should die? Is my sin so large that even if I enter into her house, then ultimately you're going to punish that person as well? Now let's think back to the argument she made. Lahazkir biavoni, she says, you're bringing my sin up by your entering here. You've now killed my child, she says to Eliyahu. What's Eliyahu saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Yes, it's true. I killed her child, but how could it be? Why am I tied to her? Hagam. Why should she be part of the collateral damage of me? You want to hurt me? Hurt me. Don't hurt her. Don't hurt her child. That's what the Mitzvah is saying, is Eliyahu's argument, which really comes down to the entire progression of all these stories. Let's think about what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing. Let's think about this for a moment. There's been three episodes of Eliyahu. Eliyahu at this point in time has decreed a famine on the land, a drought on the land. Why? Because Bnei Israel are sinning and they are unrepentant. Eliyahu says, unacceptable, he puts this curse in place. HaKadosh Baruch Hu agrees, meaning to say HaKadosh Baruch Hu follows the lead of Eliyahu, there's no rain. What does Hashem do? He takes him to three important stages of the story. First is in the brook of Kris, but that brook dries up. Eliyahu is supposed to see from here that perhaps he's supposed to see the impact of his curse, the impact of his decree. Even the water that he's drinking is drying up. Look at the impact on the earth. Eliyahu does not relent. Eliyahu does not change his mind, because Remy says the drought is going to go until I say so. So then it goes to the next step. He goes to the Ish Almana. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a certain sense, saying to him, I want you to understand the collateral damage of your curse, the collateral damage of your decree. You're going to go to the far reaches, to the very, very northmost place of the kingdom, and you're going to see even how the lowest in society, those who are most vulnerable in society, are suffering because of your decree. They're about to have their last supper. Eliyahu, have some rachmanus, have some mercy on these people. And Eliyahu doesn't. He declares a mini miracle, a very limited scope miracle, so she herself can be sustained, that the containers are not going to be emptied out. That's not going to sustain the whole town. It's barely going to sustain themselves. Eliyahu is still holding on to the justice. People are still sinning. The drought is still in motion. That's it. And finally, HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings him to a crisis beyond which there's no return, essentially. He brings about the death of this child. Could be the death of the child is related to the famine. It could be it's related to the disease which comes about because of the famine. We don't know. But Eliyahu is supposed to be asked, the question that's being asked of Eliyahu is how long will you hold the entire country and the region in debt, essentially? How long will you hold on to this curse before you see the collateral damage done upon innocence? Now Eliyahu turns around to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and he says, why should she die for me? And Hashem says, you learned your lesson. You learned your lesson. That's the point. Why should she die for you? That's exactly the point. Do you not understand that your curse was exactly that? You're asking about one child who should die? What about the tens of thousands of others who are on the point of death or are not dead already because of this famine? What about the families that were broken because of the financial climate, because they're not able to produce crops? Eliyahu, did you not think about that when you made your decree? Now, were you right? Of course you were right. Were they sinning? Yes. Did they deserve to be punished? Yes. But perhaps you need to think about the rachmanis of the situation. You're asking me for rachmanis because of one person who died because of, as a collateral damage of yourself. Think about all the other people that are dying because of your decree. That seems to be what's going on over here. This is, so to speak, the educational process of who Eliyahu is supposed to be over here, which actually brings us to a very fascinating point, and that is, who is this child? There is a discussion in the Midrash that one of the perspectives in the Midrash is to identify this child as actually being Yonah, the prophet of Yonah. And if you think about this for a second, what's fascinating about what Yonah does is that Yonah is a person who also questions the depth of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's rachamim. What happens is HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to have rachamim on the city of Nineveh. Nineveh is the capital of Assyria at the time, and they're sinning. And Hashem says to him, go to Nineveh, tell them that they have a warning. If they don't change their ways, they're going to get destroyed. And Yonah does not want to do this. Why? Because he knows that they will do tshuva. And if they do tshuva, they're going to rise into a terrible empire, which ultimately will be the one that will be responsible for the loss of many, many Israelite lives and the goddess of the northern kingdom and almost the goddess of Yerushalayim. So Yonah says, I can't do that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I can't allow you to exercise mercy in this situation. They are not worthy based on their future. I'm not going to go. In a certain sense, that's a kind of a similar thing over here. Hashem wants to have rachamim on the people, even though they've done terrible things. And even though Hashem has punished the leaders, the Baasha and Yeravam and all these other folks. But in the end of the day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not set about a unilateral decree upon the earth. That's kind of the same sort of perspective of those ravens, right? The raven taking us back to the flood, and the flood where HaKadosh Baruch Hu did have mercy on the earth and said, I won't do this kind of thing again to the entire earth. What's happening over here is Yonah struggling with the same thing. Yonah says, Din v'reshbon. Din v'reshbon that Nineveh deserves. Wipe them out. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, and you don't care about the tree that you planted, and you didn't even put any effort into it, and you should only think I should have mercy on my people, or the entire city of people and children and animals. And you don't think I should care about that? It's the same argument. The argument of MS versus Rachamim. Emes versus Shalom over here, which is happening. And that's really what Yonah is arguing. That's what Eliyahu is arguing about as well. And that actually is fascinating because the Mefarshim say that one of the aspects of how we know that Yonah is the child of this child is because what's the last word of this parak is, she says to him, I know you're an Ishilakim, Udvar Hashem Beficha Emes, you are the man of Emes, of truth. And that's exactly what Eliyahu is. And Zenit is a person who pursues truth at all costs, even some damaging costs. And you are a man of truth. What is Yonah's father's name? Yonah ben Amittai. That doesn't mean to say necessarily that he is biologically the father of this child, but it means to say that, so to speak, he brought him back to life, right? He put life in back into this child. He's the son of the man of truth, which is ultimately the struggle. And by framing it in that perspective, we see, so to speak, what the story is about. And this ultimately comes back to the very, very fascinating conclusion of the Gemara, where the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Yud Gimel and Aleph tells us a very, very fascinating spiritual idea. And that is, the Gemara says the following. It says, Shalosh Amri Le. The Pasuk says, Shalosh Mavteichos, there are three keys, Lo Nimsaru Le Shliach, that are never given over to any angel, to any intermediary in this world, that Hashem retains the control over them. Shel Chaya, birth, right? So for, you know, as much and as far as medical technology has come, and we're very blessed to be living in an age where the morbidity rates are much, much lower than a century ago, and certainly much higher than two centuries ago. We live in a very blessed time. But anybody witnessing or involved in a childbirth is very, very keenly aware of the vulnerability of a human being and how, you know, there's very little that a human being can do when things, God forbid, would go wrong in those critical moments. It's really important to remember that that's one of the keys that HaKadosh Baruch Hu owns, not necessarily the medical franchise. Then the next one is the Shel Geshamim, and we love the weathermen and everything, and they're wonderful people. But in the end of the day, if you're to say a percentage of time that they're actually accurate, that probably is a 30% chance of real rainfall being true about the weather forecast people, and Veshel Tchias Mesim, resurrection of the dead. These are the three keys. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Yoimru Shtayim Biyad Talmid V'Achas Biyad HaRav. So Hashem says, you should have two of them, and I should only have one of them. I see ha v'shakil hai. You want to take one? Give back one. What does that mean? What's the Gemara saying? Gemara is saying this. Eliyahu Navi, you felt that it was important that you made a decree on the land that there not be rain, because you're going to seek justice for the sins against God. You're doing it on my sake. Okay, you know what? I gave you one of those keys. Now, Eliyahu, you're making a second request. A request for another one of those keys, which is Tchias HaMesim, resurrection of the dead. By the way, you can see all of these ideas are life-giving forces, right? Tchaya Geshamim and Tchias HaMesim. You want another one now? You want another one? That's fine, Hashem says, but you can't have two. You got to give back one, which means that's why the Gemara says the next pasuk in the beginning of Perek Yud Ches is Leich Hera Es Acha Ve'etno Matar. Hashem says, I'm going to give the rain. Eliyahu, I'm vetoing your decree. So what essentially is that you want to resurrect the dead, that's fine, and then please give back the key of rain. And I think this is not just a quid pro quo. This is not simply, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's got him, he's worked out the stalemate. What essentially is over here is the argument about who's in control. Hashem says, you know what, I went with you along this way, and you decreed based on what Moshe Rabbeinu says in the Torah, and it's all fine and dandy, and you made a decree on my behalf in an act of zealousness. That's fine, but that's not the way I would have run the world. That's not the way I have a lot of mercy, even when people are acting really badly. So you know what? If you want to help somebody out, that's fine. I'll allow you to help them out, but I'm going to take it from here. I'm going to help everybody else out over here. And this is the transition which seems to be made over here. This is essentially, I would imagine, coming back to the full circle to the story of the Baal Shem Tov, is if you think about all the stories of Eliyahu, all the apparitions and the visitations of Eliyahu that we talk about, and we could go through all of them, but specifically this story as an example, Eliyahu is the person representing sort of the unknown figure of kindness who's there. You know, when he comes to a bris to see that Bnei Yisrael are still giving the covenant to their children and they're still connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though throughout all the centuries of persecution and hate, there are stories about understanding the complexity of Klal Yisrael, understanding the complexity of dirty and dark life that Israel has to live through and being that kind person, being that conduit, the Eliyahu HaNavi in a situation. That in a certain sense almost might be the lesson learnt from this whole perspective. It's the flip side, being the one to be mechalkel those people in need, those people who might be less than privileged in society. And perhaps that is the tikkun for the MS, which is unrelenting and has a tremendous collateral damage. So this is a fascinating perspective on Eliyahu, and this now brings us to the point where we're going to start now one of the greatest showdowns in all of Jewish history, which is at Har Carmel, which will be, God willing, our learning next week.